Marshall, will you call the next case?
Now calling case number A230755, State of Minnesota v. Drew Douglas Wiskow Davis.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. This is our third and final case on today's oral calendar. Counsel, as you probably know, you'll each have 15 minutes for your principal argument and an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant. There is a clock on the podium at the center, and feel free to adjust that up and down as needed. And I would ask that, counsel, you each introduce yourself and identify the party you're representing for our records. We do keep an audio recording of the proceedings, which will be available on our website within about 24 hours. So with that, counsel for appellant, please feel free to adjust the podium and begin when you're ready.
Thank you and good morning. May it please court. My name is Adam Chandler with the Taft Law Firm, here today as a special assistant public defender on behalf of appellant Mr. Davis. Through this appeal, Mr. Davis challenges the district court's denial of his motion to suppress all evidence due to law enforcement's unconstitutional seizure of Mr. Davis, which ultimately resulted in police uncovering evidence leading to Mr. Davis's convictions for possession of firearm ammunition by an ineligible person, receiving stolen property, and check forgery.
Mr. Here, Taylor, could I ask you a procedural question before you get too far into it?
Yes.
I noticed that your client stipulated to a court trial pursuant to subdivision, I believe it's 3 of 2601. Normally, we see when there's a desire to preserve a dispositive issue, it's under subdivision 4, and both parties would inform the court that it's a dispositive issue, and then hence go through the stipulated fact trial under that, which was previously based on the Lothenbach process, now incorporated into subdivision 4. I'm curious what, if any, impact that has in terms of whether the issue has been properly preserved when it's under subdivision 4 versus a stipulated facts trial under subdivision 3 on direct appeal.
Your Honor, I don't think that it has any effect on this court's determination. Reviewing the transcripts and the procedural history of this case, there was multiple public defenders that were involved at various points. There was confusion as to whether there would be a contested omnibus hearing. One public defender said no, one said yes. It got set up, it got taken off the calendar, it then got put on. I would say that the way that the parties and the district court handled the matter is consistent with what used to be the Lothenbach procedure, now encompassed in subdivision 4 that Your Honor referenced. The issue was not raised by the state, and I think that the court should address the appeal on the merits because of that.
Thank you.
Yes. So briefly today, I'm going to talk and explain why because law enforcement seized Mr. Davis without any reasonable articulable suspicion that he was engaged in criminal activity, and subsequently because the state failed to satisfy its burden that it obtained the evidence used to justify Mr. Davis's conviction by means sufficiently distinguishable to be purged of the taint of the unconstitutional seizure, that the district court should be reversed and the evidence against Mr. Davis should be suppressed. The background facts relevant to this appeal are short and straightforward. They're contained in the July 28th omnibus hearing transcript, as well as the officer body camera, as well as dashboard cameras. During the afternoon of April 29th, 2022, Cottage Grove Police Officer Bobick responded to a report of a suspicious vehicle in a parking lot at Walgreens in Cottage Grove. The caller.
I want to jump ahead to the fleeing part of it, because that seems problematic. Even if that initial seizure may have been invalid, he then closed the door and led the police on a high-speed chase of 100 miles an hour for 10 miles, got out of the car and fled even more, tasered him to immobilize him, and then from that found the evidence in the truck, because there's no evidence found in that initial seizure. So how do you deal with the fleeing portion?
The fleeing portion is right in line with this court's opinion in State v. Bergeson, where there was also flight from police. Less, this one was closer to 10 miles. That one was a mile. This court in State v. Bergeson and its progeny has distinguished between resisting arrest, which encompasses physical conduct, physical assault generally against officers, and mere flight, where the defendant is fleeing based on the presumption of disposing of evidence or escape of an unconstitutional seizure, which is what happened here. Bergeson is directly on point with this case. The state attempts to distinguish it by, as Your Honor raised, by noting that in Bergeson, the individual was driving when the officer activated his lights, and here you have a stopped vehicle in a parking lot. Subsequent, he takes one step out, slowly closes the door. I would note, if you watch the body cameras, which are part of the record in front of this court, it is not an abrupt leaving of the parking lot. It is a slow, deliberate. At no point was there danger to Officer Bobick. He's backed up. He's not getting hit. And it wasn't until Officer Bobick continued his pursuit, continued his attempt at an unconstitutional seizure, that the flight escalated to what Your Honor described, which is by no means a light matter, but by that I mean there's no dispute that there was a high-speed chase, but flight versus resistance with physical contact is what this court has used to distinguish when evidence must be suppressed under fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine. And here, because it is merely flight, suppression is appropriate. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Counsel, I noticed from the testimony, which really is the record for purposes of what we're reviewing today, of the officer, that he testified that the citizen complaint, which we'll presume to be valid or accurate because it's a citizen, identified a black Suburban, gave the license plate. He testified that he ran that license plate, but it came back to a blue GMC Yukon. Now, I didn't see this in the judge's order or argued by the state at district court level. In fact, I don't see it argued in the briefing today. Would that not be a traditional plate swapping crime, a misdemeanor, be formed the basis, an objective basis for the officer to have asked for the ID, which is where everybody says the seizure began, and perhaps ask him to step out?
If that was part of the record, I think that might be an appropriate.
Well, that's part of why I'm asking. It is in the transcript, so that's part of the record. It wasn't argued, but would you agree that that would be a law violation such that the seizure would be lawful under a Terry-type stop?
No, and I'll read a quote for why it's not relevant to this court's determination. While if it had been raised by Officer Bobick in the omnibus hearing, it may have very well been. The quote comes from State v. Cripps, Minnesota Supreme Court, and then this is consistently, quoted, going to, I think, the 2020 Minnesota Supreme Court case. And the quote is, to reasonably suspect a person of criminal activity, the officer's suspicion must be based on specific, articulable facts. The officer, and this is the important sentence, the officer must be able to articulate at the omnibus hearing that he or she had a particularized and objective basis for suspecting the seized person of criminal activity. Why that matters. In that case, there was facts similar, meaning that there were facts in the record that were not raised by the officer at the omnibus hearing. The state argued at the Supreme Court, in considering whether reasonable articulable suspicion exists, we should consider those facts. The Supreme Court said in Cripps and has said repeatedly since then, no. The officer has to say at the omnibus hearing what facts led to the seizure of the individual, and here it is patently clear that the only, from both the squad video, the dash cam video, and the testimony, that the only basis for the seizure of Mr. Davis was the innocuous suspicious vehicle report, which stated that there was a black man and a white woman sitting in a vehicle in a Walgreens parking lot that was properly parked during the day, and that they were smoking something and the female was acting erratically. That's it. And Minnesota Supreme Court precedent, along with United States Supreme Court precedent, demonstrates that while identified informant tips are presumed to be reliable, and appellant does not challenge that presumption here, they must identify with some particularity the actual conduct that leads to a reasonable inference of criminal activity. And here, that simply doesn't exist. That what was set forth in the tips received from the informant is innocent, perfectly legal behavior. Officer Bobick acknowledged during the omnibus hearing that he observed no illegal behavior as he approached the vehicle and subsequently seized Mr. Davis. And the cases that are particularly on point for that proposition are the United States Supreme Court case, Florida v. JL. In that case, you had an informant. That one was an unidentified informant, slightly different. I don't believe it makes any material difference in this court's evaluation. The report identified that a young black man was wearing a plaid shirt, identified a particular location. Based on that tip, police went to that location, observed three black men, frisked them all, identified JL, found a gun on him. And the state argued that the seizure was proper because the informant identified the individual with particularity, identified the location, which subsequently led to the frisk and the arrest. The United States Supreme Court rejected that argument, holding that the seizure was unconstitutional because while that description was accurate, the tip failed to show that the informant had knowledge of concealed criminal activity and that reasonable suspicion required a tip to be reliable, and here's a quote, reliable in its assertion of illegality, not just in its tendency to identify a determinate person. That's all that exists here. There was a reliable tip of what an untrained citizen believed to be suspicious activity. That tip, I can't conceive what you can take those facts and say this leads to criminal activity.
Would you agree, Mr. Chandler, that an officer doesn't need a reasonable articulable suspicion of criminal activity to approach a parked car, for instance, like he did here?
Certainly, 100%.
Your point being is, and it sounds like everybody agrees, the seizure was about the moment he asked for a driver's license, which was quickly followed up by stepping out because he didn't have one.
Correct, so
you would agree everything was lawful up to that point. Your sole argument for error is that when he asked for the driver's license and or step out of the vehicle, there was no articulation of a reasonable criminal suspicion of any crime.
That is correct, Your Honor. I looked at the potential argument of whether the police vehicle being 3 to 4 feet behind the appellant's vehicle would have amounted to a seizure. Minnesota case law is contrary to that proposition. So
and he was able to get around without hitting the car.
You are correct.
I'm actually impressed by the driving at that stage, not anything after that, but it looked like he had to kind of swerve a little bit to the right to avoid the officer's car and then leave.
Yes. Appellant agrees with your statement of what we are challenging, which is that the seizure occurred at the moment Officer Bobek, and frankly, it sounds like you've watched the video, rolls down the window, asks him for identification almost immediately, and then says, step out of the car. That's when the seizure happened. That's what the district court held. And
this would be distinguished from the U.S. Supreme Court Mims case because there was not a traffic stop for which an officer would have need no reason to ask someone to step out of a car if it's a valid traffic stop. Here, it was not a traffic stop because the car is already stopped.
That is correct, Your Honor. Yes. The other case on that particular point, oh, I see my time is up. I apologize.
That's okay. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So at this point, we will turn to counsel for respondent.
Thank you.
Again, feel free to adjust the podium as you wish. There are 15 minutes on the clock, and you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, and may it please the court, my name is Andrew Jackala. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota. As an initial matter, I would take issue with one of the comments my esteemed colleague raised about the JL case, suggesting that it is immaterial that in that case, the citizen informant chose to remain anonymous. I take a different view. I think it's critically important that in that case, the report was anonymous. And in this case, the caller was willing to identify herself, which suggests reliability in the account. And her willingness to remain accountable to the report that she's making.
Isn't that, Mr. Jackala, that there's really no dispute as to the reliability of what this caller said, but she didn't articulate a crime, right? And in fact, would it be true the officer, but for the one exception of the plate that I mentioned, did not articulate a crime, and in fact, in cross-examination, repeatedly said, I observe no crime?
Those are the facts, Your Honor.
So what would you say is the crime that would support the seizure, which I understand you agree at the time of asking for a driver's license and or stepping out of the vehicle?
Well, I think to properly answer that question, we need to take a look at what the reasonable suspicion standard demands. And the reasonable suspicion standard suggests that an officer must only recognize the criminal activity may be afoot. There doesn't need to be a proven crime. This isn't a probable cause standard. It's reasonable suspicion.
So what's the crime that is afoot?
I think the suggestion is that there was some kind of criminal drug use going on, that there may be a situation where one of the individuals involved may have been in distress due to the erratic actions that were observed by the passenger. The record isn't entirely clear, but we've got statements attached to the complaint suggesting that this female passenger was outside of the car. The caller observed the two individuals in the car smoking something.
I'm kind of getting to the point where the officer's at the window looking in, because then counsel for appellant agrees that would not require reasonable articulable suspicion, but he testified consistently. He didn't smell anything from a drug, from the smoke, and whatever erratic she was, it appeared to be, and the video seems to support this, to have calmed down significantly by the time he had got there, and she's in the car. So I just don't see anywhere that, other than, and maybe I should just ask you this, I didn't see you argued the plate swapping as the crime to further expand this incident to a seizure.
Yeah, and thank you, Your Honor. That point was not raised at the district court level. There was, in fact, some confusion at the early stage of the case as to what the situation was with the plates. The plates were later determined to have been stolen. I think at the time that the officer made the encounter, the issue was the identification of the vehicle. And there, we're talking about a GMC Yukon versus a Chevy Suburban, I think, were the two descriptions. And those vehicles are very similar and in size and body. And at that point, there was, it appeared as though there was some confusion, perhaps, about why the vehicle did not match the plates. But at that point, there wasn't necessarily firm indicia of a crime having been committed. But the fact that there is this discrepancy certainly would raise alarm bells and would suggest to the officer in that situation the criminality, again, may be afoot. There's something that needs to be investigated here. We've got a citizen informant calling in a report about suspicious behavior, and we've got this discrepancy in the license plate. That is why the reasonable suspicion standard is where it is. It's so that officers can use their police skills to investigate issues that that are raised in the course of a report and in a stop.
So, counsel, how do you respond to the statement made by attorney for the appellant that the officer has to say what their reasonable articulable suspicion was at the omnibus hearing, and that if he didn't say anything about the plate being switched or possible confusion about whether this was the correct vehicle and why it would have a different plate number on it, are we not able to look at that?
No, I definitely think you are able to look at it, and that's because the circumstances of this particular stop, the investigation about what type of criminality may be occurring was cut short by the driver's decision to flee the scene. The driver didn't want to talk about the fact that there was ammunition in the vehicle, that plates were stolen, that there were forged checks in the vehicle, and chose to take his chances by taking off from the officer before the officer could ask some of these questions that might probe a bit further to raise it to the level of probable cause. So the issue is that the officer was short-circuited by the driver's act of fleeing.
Did the officer ever testify about the plates, the mismatched plates?
It did come up at the omnibus hearing, Your Honor. The officer didn't offer much in the way of testimony about that, except to explain the difference in the models of the vehicles. One really important fact that I think really bolsters the reliability, the credibility of this reporter, is that certain facts were corroborated. And one of those facts is that the license plate on the vehicle at the time were the same plate numbers that were reported during the call. And I think it's the Navarette decision from the United States Supreme Court that says with every bit of corroboration from the report to what the officer sees, the informant's reliability goes up and up and up to the point that the officer can make a determination that this call was reliable and that I do have something further to investigate. And when we're looking at the legal issues raised, we have to remember that we're not looking at it from the perspective of three appellate court judges asking an attorney about it. We're back in the situation in that parking lot where the officer is entering somewhat of an unknown situation and has to make determinations on a moment-by-moment basis in order to ascertain what is going on and what criminality may be occurring. So this critical feature is the reliability of the reporter, and that does establish reasonable suspicion.
Mr. Jackala, how do you respond to the point Mr. Chandler made that if we were to agree that there's no basis for the stop, that the intervening cause, which you're arguing, would purge, that would seem to be contrary to our court's case in Ferguson because it had very similar facts and clearly delineated the distinction between physical, which I think was the Ingram case, any form of physical altercation with an officer versus just leaving, which in both cases, I think the quote was, it would be human nature when someone's caught at something to flee and for the purpose of hiding the contraband. And here it seems, and when you do look at the video, I didn't see the officer in harm at all. And in fact, he calmly backed up and called for backup because he knew exactly what was about to happen. And the car did, in fact, kind of calmly, it did a pretty good maneuver to avoid the officer's car and then got on the street. And then, of course, that's when all the bad stuff happened. But that's all irrelevant, I assume, to the question of whether there was a Bergeson type of intervening act that, or an Ingram type of intervening act that might purge the state of illegal conduct.
And if I'm understanding your question correctly, whether this is whether the fact that there is no use of force by the driver, if that is a critical fact.
Well, Bergeson said it was. I mean, our court made it pretty clear, distinguished that from Ingram, where there was some form of physical interference with the officer as part of the intervening act.
Yeah. I understand the case law personally. I think it's a fairly arbitrary point that may get some more attention from the Supreme Court later down the road. But with the case law that we are talking about here, I think Bergeson is clearly distinguishable because there was no face-to-face interaction between the officer and the driver in Bergeson. We've got an officer who observed some kind of furtive movement in the vehicle while it's driving. The officer lit up the lights and initiated a stop, but the driver didn't stop for at least a mile. Here, we've got a situation more like Ingram, where we do have the face-to-face encounter. We've got an officer approaching a suspect, asking questions, and the driver taking off, leaving that face-to-face interaction. And I believe that there was certainly an element of danger associated with this event, not only with the fleeing, but also with the chase that ensued. But looking directly at the moment that Mr. Davis did flee, I take a different view of the body-worn camera video footage. I still believe there was a danger to the officer due to the size of this vehicle, the methods of egress, that this officer could have been injured during the course of the suspect fleeing. And to create a distinction based on whether somebody brushed up against an officer, like in Ingram, or possibly imperiled a driver by moving a large vehicle in close proximity to the driver trying to escape a situation where he had been seized, I believe that's exactly the type of situation that the case law supports. And I'll just leave it at that to say that this is more along the lines of Ingram than Bergeson. And I think we can also look at this case involving, as cited in my brief, the marijuana being thrown out of a home. The name of the case escapes me at this moment, but there was a search of a house and multiple occupants in the house, and somebody threw marijuana out the window. That's a clear attempt to conceal evidence or to purge evidence. What we have here is an individual not necessarily trying to hide evidence, but to get away from the situation and to leave the officer behind, short-circuiting the interrogation, the limited investigation that did imperil not only the driver, but then subsequently anybody who was on the roadway during these busy hours during a 100-mile-an-hour police chase.
Did the officer offer any testimony about the smoke that was in the car?
No, the officer indicated that he did not actually smell anything inside the vehicle, and I don't view that as entirely problematic. I'm certainly no expert in marijuana vaping, but to my understanding, if somebody's using a pen cartridge type device to smoke marijuana or any other drug, it's not necessarily going to give the same type of lingering aroma that perhaps a joint or some other form of ingestion would. So I'm not concerned with that.
It seems to me, and speaking for myself, that the between the call where it's smoking something and distressed person in a car, that maybe there's a valid reason to go check on the person, do a welfare check, and figure out what's happening here. But it's not illegal for two people to be sitting in a car and having an argument. Maybe they're getting a divorce. Maybe they're breaking up. There could be all sorts of reasons that are totally valid for them to be sitting in that car and having an argument and smoking something, which we don't know what that something is because the caller didn't say, and the cop has no testimony of what that something is.
Yeah, I agree. It's not illegal to sit in a vehicle and have a conversation, but the officer didn't know what's happening. He didn't know if they're just having a lover's quarrel or if the driver is telling the passenger that I've got your three kids locked up in a car and there's a bomb bomb in there. These are the things that the officer needs to be able to probe upon a report of erratic behavior.
But why does the officer need the identification of the individuals to go do that welfare check? Why? Because we all agree that's the point where the seizure occurred. So if the seizure occurred at the point where the officer says, give me some identification, the officer had every right to just have a conversation and say, what's going on here? Are you guys okay? And then from there, maybe reasonable articular suspicion of a crime starts developing. But at the point where the conversation was very early in the conversation, the officer says, give me some ID. And so they were seized at that point. But I don't know what the criminal investigation was at that point in time.
And I see that my time is up. Judge Wheelock, may
please,
I respond?
Yeah, please do answer.
When the officer approached the vehicle, I believe that's what the intent was, is to have this conversation and find out primarily what's happening with this passenger who's acting erratically and crying. And he could see, maybe not that she is crying in that moment, but that she was upset and had been crying. And the officer did try to engage both the driver and the passenger, but got nothing in response.
But that engagement was... give me some identification.
Right, and I can't get into the officer's head. There wasn't any testimony at the omnibus hearing about that. I think the point that we have to remember here is that we're in a courtroom, not in a parking lot where there's been a report of this type of behavior. So the officer, it's a fluid situation. Reasonable suspicion is a fluid concept, and we need to go with that and trust that the officer was attempting to make the type of investigatory search that he's allowed to do under the law, but he ran into some encounters. There's some evidence that the driver was acting in a nervous manner, looking around the vehicle when asked about ID, and I think all these things building upon one another led the officer to conclude that there was criminality afoot, whether that be some type of threatening behavior toward the passenger or some type of illegal drug use.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And we will turn back to counsel for appellant for the final word here today. There are 5 minutes on the clock.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Before I get into my rebuttal points, if there's any questions, I can field them before I jump in, but
I would like you to address the intervening circumstance and just sort of walk us through why we should not find that the fleeing in the vehicle was an intervening circumstance here.
I would say the opening brief of mine, there's four factors that this court looks at in determining whether to disregard under fruit of poisonous tree. We're considering factor two. You have to look at all four factors. They're considered in totality. The state doesn't dispute one, three, or four. So those already go to appellant side. Limited to factor two, the argument literally quotes this court's opinion in Bergeson. Another thing I would like to point out is opposing counsel in trying to distinguish these cases, which are so factually similar, talks about again, the car being stopped versus in Bergeson, the car moving. And what I would like to point out is that under Minnesota law, and this is a statute, there is that is no distinguishing factor. The statute I'd like to refer the court to is Minnesota Statute 609.487, in particular, Subdivision 3. The first subdivisions go on to define and discuss fleeing a police officer in motor vehicle. What's required to satisfy that? In Bergeson, and in this case, that statute is met for both. That there is no distinguishing facts. Whether the vehicle was moving and then continued a mile after police lights were activated, or a vehicle was stopped and subsequently the driver got in and fled, we are looking under Minnesota statutory law at the same factors. There, and again, I would just go back to the court's reasoning in Bergeson. The way that Minnesota law stands now is the distinguishing factor is whether there is just flight or whether there is resisting, which necessarily under Minnesota law encompasses assault, physical resistance of some kind. None of that happened here.
It does seem different, though, that you have a face-to-face contact here, where they're having a conversation, and then in the middle of the conversation, the defendant pulls the car out and starts fleeing. And so if we were to agree with you here, are we encouraging then folks to just run when they feel like the cop doesn't have reasonable articulable suspicion?
On that point, I would note that there are other cases, I can't remember them off the top of my head, I believe they're cited in my briefing, that have relied on Bergeson for this principle. I do not recall anywhere an individual got into a vehicle subsequent to a face-to-face interaction, but I believe there have been some where there was a face-to-face interaction and then flight on foot, and Bergeson applied. The way the law stands now, and I just want to, you know, my coming around is it the way the case law is written is there's a physical resistance or flight, and unless and until that point is refined further, and I would suggest that it would have to be by the Minnesota Supreme Court, that is Minnesota law, and that's what this court should follow.
What happens if we get into a scenario where there's a crash and he crashes in and hurts somebody? Is that something that then can be charged, even though the flight started from this exact same scenario?
Under that hypothetical, maybe. I think some of it has to do with the charging decisions made by the prosecutor's office. I referred your honors to a particular statute that could have been utilized in this case and was not. That statute would not have relied on anything, any fruit of the poisonous tree. And in fact, that statute has a particular subdivision on crash and great bodily harm when there is flight from an officer. So I don't think that this court needs to go to that granular level because the legislature has already done so.
Would reckless driving be something that, if you're going 100 miles an hour, there's a reckless driving type of charges that could be faced here? I mean, there was the initial stop, the flight, but then the flight was, in and of itself, 100 miles an hour, putting people in danger.
I see my time is up. May I answer?
Please answer.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that goes back to, I don't think we're necessarily in fruit of the poisonous tree at that point, because you have a law enforcement officer that observes reckless driving, and you are not dealing with evidence that was subsequently uncovered, physical evidence subsequently uncovered, that stems from directly an unconstitutional seizure, if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your briefs and for the argument here today. The case is under advisement, and we will issue an opinion in the statutory time frame. And with that, that ends today's calendar, and the court is in recess.
Please rise.